You're listening to Talkback Gardening, Paul Culliver and John Lamb on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Welcome to Talkback Gardening. Paul Culliver with you just for today. Deb Tribe taking a very well-earned break over the Easter long weekend. And John Lamb joining me. Good morning.
Good morning, Paul. And you seem to be enjoying this morning's program.
I'm having a grand old time. On your radio across ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill. And of course on the podcast too, which you can download if you miss anything or want to catch up. John, what are we going to talk about today?
Paul, the way you water your vegetables is critical. And so many gardeners during summer have failures because of the way they water or don't water. They forget to water or something goes wrong and the plants just don't get the water they need. There is an answer. The answer is a wicking bed.
A wicking bed.
A wicking bed.
Okay. Yeah.
And I'm not going to explain what a wicking bed is. I'll introduce probably one of the state's top authorities on wicking beds, Mark Smith from the Adelaide Hills Veggie Gardens. Good morning to you, Mark.
Good morning.
This is the third time, I think, we've had you on. I think you were one of the first to talk about wicking beds in South Australia quite a number of years ago.
Yeah, we've done this a few times.
And wicking beds have changed considerably. But before we go any further, there are a lot of people saying, but what's a wicking bed? What's it look like?
It can come in any shape and size. It's basically a self-watering pot. It just happens to be quite large and has a reservoir of water underneath it.
So let's build one. I mean, that's what you do. First of all, you've drawn from your scientific background and looked at the critical factors like the reservoir of water and how deep it is and how much potting mix you put on top of it. So just bearing in mind that we're on radio, just describe a wicking bed, a typical wicking bed from the bottom up.
So you basically need a completely lined system. So if you use a good quality pond liner, you'll have a watertight vessel. Shapes and sizes can be really up to you. And then on top of that, you start putting your reservoir material. So people like Sophie Thompson have made scoria and gravel sort of the number one choice. That basically enables you to hold the water, but also provide the support to then put your soil on top of that. You normally would put a layer of geotextile or shade cloth to separate the soil from the water. The amount of water or the depth of the reservoir really depends on the medium that's inside it. So for things like gravel, it's about 70% rock, 30% water. Scoria holds a little bit more water per sort of square metre.
It's getting those dimensions right that is often the problem when people are making a wicking bed. So we've got a big box. You've got it lined with a pond liner or something like that. And then traditionally people have put in their rocks or their gravel and things like that. Now, you've gone one step further than that and there are new technologies available. So instead of putting in gravel or rock and things like that and trying to work out how much level you need, what have we got?
So it's an Australian-designed product called a WaterUps Wicking Cell.
Say that again.
A WaterUps Wicking Cell.
WaterUps Wicking Cell.
So it's a genius little product because it basically looks like a little flat tray with four legs. It's made from recycled plastic. So all of our plastic that could have gone to landfill has been diverted into this wonderful product. It's a food grade plastic. And it now sits in the bottom of your reservoir. So you've got your pond liner. And instead of putting any gravel or scoria or any other media in there, you literally just put these trays in place and then your soil goes on top of that.
It's so very much like if you had a water pot or something like that. It is, you know, there's the level and there's just a plastic container which holds the water.
Absolutely. That's all it is. It's such a simple, simple design, isn't it?
So, okay, you've got your box, you've got it's nicely lined, you plonk these plastic trays in, which have got four little legs, I presume that's to sort of soak up the water.
Yes,
and then on top of that, you just put your potting mix on top of that?
Yes, yeah, you put it straight
simple
on.
Simple as that.
You don't need your geotextile liner because it's a solid tray, it's not going to fall through. So then it just comes down to the choice of soil. The same, I guess, rules apply to the soil. It has to be well-draining, rich in organic content. And then you've got 30 to 40 centimetres considered the maximum height that water can wick. So that's the maximum height you can put soil into.
So these little trays, they work out, they determine for you how much water goes into the bottom of the container.
So these, using these cells, you get 100 litres of water per square metre of the cells.
Okay, it's all scientific.
It is. It's quite. It's well. They've actually done a lot of research on it,
yes.
And that enables you to go 4 weeks between watering.
Hey, that's wonderful. It's 4 weeks and no watering. Yeah,
yeah. That's how long your holiday is allowed to be.
Yes, even if you're growing tomatoes in the middle of summer, you probably might use up a bit more water then.
Yeah, I got down to about 3 weeks in the middle of summer during those 40-plus weeks. So, yeah.
All right, so I think we've described the wicking bed with the new invention. These, again, say the name of it.
It's called a water-up wicking cell.
Water-up wicking cell. Right, OK, so there it is, the water-ups wicking... say it for me.
Water-ups wicking cell.
There we are.
That's okay. A good warm-up, isn't it? A good tongue twister for you.
Is it ever? Yeah, sure. Anyway, and you put your potting mix on that and then we'll take a look at some of the things that might go wrong. But I think we're starting to get questions coming in already, Paul. Just before you do introduce the guest, if you don't mind, Paul, it's important, I think, people have had experience with it. And so whether it's good experience or bad experience, now's the time, I think, to share that information because it's tremendously important that people can raise issues, which I don't think about. I've not had a wicking bed. And I think it's from the practical people that we'd like to hear their point of view.
All right, well, let's get those experiences. Let's get that conversation going. If you want to give us a call, we've got South Australia's number one wicking bed expert here with us, 1300 222 891, 1300 222 891, if you've got a question about wicking beds. And our first cab off the rank is Graham from Lewiston. Good morning. Have you got you there, Graham? You there? Oh, what's going on here? Don't seem to have found him.
Oh, we'll see. He's disappeared.
Graham, you there? Oh, we've got a line. We don't have a Graham.
Okay.
Well, there you go. We'll see if we can find Graham there. If you do have a call about wicking beds, 1300 222 891. Graham, if you're listening and you're wondering what's going on, maybe call back because I think the line might have done something strange while you were waiting to talk.
All right, so let's continue our discussion. So we've got the water all sorted out. 100 litres to the square metre, that's beaut. The potting mix or soil, should it be a potting mix or a soil? Does it make any difference?
It does. It does because you need something that can wick or can drain. So they're basically the same principle. One just happens to go up and one goes down. You need plenty of organic matter in there because one of the... excuse me. One of the... cons, I guess, of a wicking bed is that it's completely separate from the rest of your garden, so you need to constantly put in your compost. So for me, something like a potting mix is probably a little too coarse. It's probably not going to hold quite enough moisture. You can enrich it with a bit of organic matter or manures and things like that. Most landscapers will sell you a product called a veggie and garden mix, which again will do the job for you. The other one is potentially getting something which is a bit of a mixture of sandy loam and compost, because I think that's probably a little richer and a little better at holding the moisture. And
all right.
Wicking.
So what you want is good drainage,
yep.
But you've got also the need to be able to hold on to moisture, and also the ability for the water to get from the reservoir at the bottom, and just explain how it wicks up and how far it wicks up and what could go wrong there.
So wicking, for those who don't know, is basically capillary action. It's the way a liquid moves against the force of gravity, so it's the way a candle works. If you took a little square of paper toweling and put it into a glass of red cordial, you'd watch the red cordial move up your paper towel, and it's nothing magic to do with the paper towel. It's literally just the capillary action in action. That's how that works.
The depth of that soil or potting mix, how critical is that?
Very critical, because obviously the liquid is fighting gravity and it can only do it so much. So we usually say between 30 and 40 centimetres is as far as it goes. And you'll know when you've got too much soil because that top layer of soil is going to be bone dry and you'll have to dig down quite a way before it starts to get moist. And so it's a really good indicator that you've got too much soil in you. in your wicking bed.
I think we've frightened everybody off with their calls.
I just want to say that we did get a text message, and I wanted to run this by you, Mark. A text message here saying, off the back of our wicking bed conversation, I use old golf balls to act as a base layer for my deep pots. Have you ever heard of something like that? Would that play in a wicking bed?
Absolutely. It's basically just creating space to hold your soil up, and there's probably a lot of gaps between your golf balls. How a golf ball survives in water for an extended period of time is something I don't know.
Quite fascinating. Yeah, lots of variations on the theme. And many people have invented their own kind of a wicking bed. But I suppose, Mark, you've spent a lot of your time as a research scientist looking at those critical factors of water and potting mix and things like that. So let's draw from that. Nutrition. A plant needs nutrients. You've got your original potting mix. You run out of that. So do you fertilise the potting mix or do you put it into the water?
You could do both, but if you fertilise your water, you probably are then going to need to have a way of draining that entire reservoir and refreshing it, which for me personally goes against the whole water efficiency principle of a wicking bed. I prefer to advise people to actually take out maybe about a wheelbarrow load's worth of soil and then add back in your compost and manures and blood and bone and things like that and really dig it in deep. Because obviously the water is coming from the bottom, so it's going to draw your nutrients up as opposed to normally in a normal garden when it's going to bring it down. So just putting your fertilisers or compost or manures on the surface of a wicking bed is going to be quite an inefficient use of those.
Okay, so the nutrients are in the potting mix. It rains. What's likelihood of the rain leaching the nutrients down into the water?
It's possible, absolutely.
Does it matter?
Those nutrients should also come back up again. So I don't think that there's really an issue. I've had wicking beds now for nearly 6 years, and at no point has my reservoir got all smelly from too many nutrients or anything like that. So I don't actually have any bottom draining valves in any of my wicking beds. I think that's a possibility. But again, it comes down to, what are you using? If you're using organic compost and manures, most of that is going to be stuck inside your garden bed and the roots can get to it. Whereas if you start putting in large amounts of chemical fertilisers, which are basically just salts, then you have the potential of all those being leached down into your reservoir and creating basically a salty reservoir.
We're talking with Mark Smith, Wicking Beds, and we'll take a look at some of the potential problems, but Paul, I suspect that we're starting to get a question.
Indeed, we have on 1300 222 891. We have found Graham from Lewiston. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I've got 14 wicking beds, and just as a general comment, on that day when we were 48 degrees out here, everything bar some Chinese cabbage seedlings just powered through that day without any problems, yet I struggled with some of the plants in the garden. But my question is, with rhubarb, it doesn't like wet feet. Are wicking beds not suitable for them?
It's great to hear that your tomatoes did really well, and that's one of the things that I've really seen with a lot of the clients who've got amazing tomatoes this year.
Yes, we'll come back to that because that's important. But, that's right. Not all plants need the same amount of water. So rhubarb is one of those things. The Achilles heel, of course, is wet feet.
Yeah, and I've actually had people tell me that they've successfully grown rhubarb and asparagus and things like that into a wicking bed. The moisture level in a wicking bed is not wet. I think that's a bit of a misconception about the idea that because you've got water underneath it, your soil is going to be constantly wet. It's moist, not wet, because whilst the water can wick up, it also can drain back down. So you're not going to end up with a very high level of water. I grew garlic the last few years in a wicking bed, and according to Garlic Association people, you really shouldn't be growing garlic in a wicking bed because the roots are too big and they like to get dried out as well. So I think wicking beds are still quite new to a lot of people, and some of the things that we can do and can't do are still being discovered. So I'd certainly be interested to hear from people who do grow things like asparagus
and garlic, yeah, because at the end of the season you've got to, well, I suppose, cure the bulb by withdrawing the water.
That's what I've heard, and that's what I spoke to people about that, and that's what they were, a bit confused that I was able to get a decent garlic crop out of it, and they were able to stay. They lasted quite a few months afterwards.
So. Okay, Graham, we come back to you. Are you happy with that?
Yes, just actually on the garlic, I grew two lots of garlic last year, one in a wicking bed to see how it would go, one in the ordinary garden, and the one in the ordinary garden actually produced the biggest and the best bulbs.
Yep. So that's an interesting observation. Was there much difference between the soil as far as the nutrition was concerned?
No, basically identical.
Oh, that's another one of those great data points that I like getting from people because, again, all these sorts of things are quite new, so finding out that people are getting more success in some things versus others is always good to hear.
Probably the way you plant would be important too. So if the things which are things that don't like wet feet, like rhubarb, might be sort of put with the garlic, which also doesn't need, except it needs water to start with.
Yeah.
Yeah, but working out which are the friends to plant together, I suppose, is one of experience.
Yeah, yeah. And garlic has quite, I've been told that garlic has extensive root systems up to sort of 50, 60 centimetres. So in a wicking bed, when you've only got 30 to 40 centimetres of soil, it's possible that things like garlic are actually getting their roots right down into the water reservoir and actually getting wet roots, which might be the part of the problem there.
Mark, we've got problems. I've got about 6 or 7 or maybe 10 questions I want to ask, but they're coming in thick and
lots
fast.
Lots of calls coming through here.
So stand back and, enjoy.
ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill is what you tune to. My name is Paul Culver, in for Deb Tribe, but we've got John Lamb here with Talk Back Gardening and Mark Smith from Adelaide Hills Veggie Gardens taking your calls on wicking beds on 1300 222 891. I should mention a lot of people messaging through photos of their wicking beds, showing them off, which is lovely.
Oh, lovely. Nice.
A quick question here on the text message too, just very quickly. Can you buy a wicking bed kit? I'm not a handyman.
The short answer to that is yes. I guess I'm not allowed to plug that that's what I do.
No, but if they ask the right questions in the right place.
Yes, yes, if you were to look on...
If you Google wicking beds Adelaide Hills, you're...
That's enough breadcrumbs to go there.
Yeah, and we need to come back to those little trays too. I think you're the distributor in South Australia of those little trays, so you can't buy them from a green shed or a garden centre. You've actually got to go. You've got to be able to find you to be able to buy those. You buy them in little packs, don't you?
Yes, yeah, they come in packs of 12, which is about 2 square metres worth of wicking bed.
Okay.
You're listening to Talk Back Gardening with Paul Culliver and John Lamb on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
And our guest today, Mark Smith from the Adelaide Hills Veggie Gardens. Let's get straight to a call. We've got lots of calls coming through, so let's get through some of them. Jane from Norwood, good morning.
Hi. Look, I'm just wondering whether anyone has had experience growing Australian natives in wicking beds, please.
Again, that's a fairly new question. I've had a few people recently putting in regular trees and fruit trees into wicking beds. So at this stage, I don't have any information to provide on whether that's successful. But I guess the biggest question you've got to ask is how big would the root balls of some of these plants be? Because you are limited to only a maximum of about 40 centimetres worth of soil. So any plant or any tree that goes into that is probably going to be naturally dwarfed because of its restriction of its root growth. So it apparently depends on what sort of native plants you've got. The other issue with the native plants is they have very different nutritional requirements compared to your veggies and your other plants. So selecting the soil in that situation would be much, much more critical.
So anybody that has got a wicking bed and has grown or is growing native plants, could they try and, even they send us a text with a contact number, I wouldn't mind following that one up. That's a very interesting one.
Yeah, really good question, Jane. Let's go to Dee from McLaren Flats. Good morning to you.
Hi there, guys. Interesting conversation about the asparagus and rhubarb. My rhubarb died too. The asparagus is doing all right. And I had the best crop of tomatoes this year in our wicking bed. We've got the IVCs, like Sophie's.
Oh, yes,
and
okay.
I found that brassicas have done really well, cucumbers, most of the summer veggies. So, yeah, I didn't realise that you'd already got a caller talking about the rhubarb. I just wanted to say...
No, that's all contributions.
Don't grow rhubarb.
Have you tried herbs, coriander and basil and things like that?
No, I've got them mainly in wine barrels.
That's all right. No, just curious.
Yeah.
No, it's relatively new, and I think we learn, and the best way of learning is from other people's experience, and that's the value, of course, of talkback gardening, because we can get people in and share the information.
Yeah, love it. Okay, cheers.
Love it. Thanks, Dee from McLaren Fats. The wicking bed community is coming out of the woodwork this morning. 1-300-222-891. Really lovely to hear all these stories of successes and, in some cases, failures, which we learn from too, of course. Jeff from Normanville, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
Oh, good morning, gentlemen. I'd like to find whether you can grow an avocado tree in a wicking bed.
Yeah, we're testing.
Mark's had quite the visceral reaction to that.
Not only grow it, but hopefully obtain some fruit from the plant.
Again, that's completely and utterly new to me. I love the idea that people are really pushing what we can do with these wicking beds, and putting trees and things like that in it is something that I really haven't got a lot of information about.
No, you'd need a giant wicking bed because there's a ratio between the number of leaves a plant can support and the amount of root system it's got. And so if you want a decent-sized tree, it's got to have lots of leaves, and if it's going to produce flowers and fruits, it needs even more roots. And so you'd probably have to have a giant wicking system underneath it to support it. But then I may be quite incorrect because if you've got your water and it's concentrated in a small area, so long as the tree can get its water, who knows? So help.
I think with trees we really are in that position now where we can think, well, we can only wick water 30 to 40 centimetres, but can we put in twice as much soil and just help the tree get the roots down deeper so it develops a bigger root mass so that a large chunk of those roots are actually down in the wicking zone. There will be a top area which is probably going to be reasonably dry, but with mulching and a little bit of top watering, you can probably get around some of that information. It's really going to be that restriction on the root ball. So if we basically bend the rules a little bit and see whether we can help, because I think with wicking beds, there's a lot of rules out there that kind of restrict people.
There's an arborist with one of the councils that's done some wonderful work on watering street trees. And Tim Johnson, if you're listening, you're going to get a phone call during the week.
All right. Well, I think, Jeff, I think you've got to try then and let us know how you go.
Okay, will do. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
That's your experiment to try for us. Jeff from Normanville. We've also got Bernie from Brighton. Let's talk to Bernie. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. I've got a provocative question about wicking beds. Why do we use soil and compost in it at all? If the nutrients come from the bottom, why don't we provide just the substrate to hold the roots and, a mixture optimized for wicking, let's say, coarse sand and some organic, stuff, water-holding stuff in there? When you look where they grow tomatoes commercially in greenhouses.
That's right. Yeah, we're talking hydroponics, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. That's the very premise of hydroponics, and that's partly based upon the wicking principle, in using a soilless matrix, so basically a perlite or a vermiculite or some of those types of products that enable you to basically supply the substance to be able to put the roots and hold the roots in place, but they don't actually offer any nutrients. All the nutrient is coming from that liquid that's coming from
below. That's right, and getting the liquid right and making sure you don't get the pH going wrong and things like that. Yeah. Whereas you're suggesting that you put your nutrient in the soil and basically you rely on the slow release of nutrients by having lots of organic matter, composty type materials, that provides the nutrients it needs. And it's coming out of the soil where the roots are, rather than the roots are taking up the water out of the reservoir.
Yes.
All right. Thanks so much, Bernie. Let's go to Sharon from Harndorf. Good morning.
Good morning there. My husband has built a wicking bed at our place at Harndorf. And what he's done in that, I say we all the time, but in this regard it's he, has got two small worm farms in the wicking bed. So we have a large worm farm separate to the wicking bed, but these two worm farms in there work really well, and the worms are, you know, fertilising the whole thing, and, you know, we're, yeah, it's just a great way to keep some nutrients in the soil.
That's a smart one, yeah. Have you seen one of those?
Yeah, that's something that I've been doing for several years.
And goodness gracious.
That's part of what we
supply. So the worm farm is a separate little sort of pot?
I mean, a worm farm in soils, if you go to a garden centre and they might sell you in-ground worm farms, they're basically just a pipe or a pot with a bunch of holes in them. So the same principle can be applied. You get an old flower pot, put some holes around the side, bury that up to the lid in your wicking bed, and you've now provided the worms the perfect way to survive in Adelaide summer, because when it gets really hot, they disappear into your soil and they start, you know, doing what normally earthworms would be doing, but you've got composting worms that are doing that job, as well as composting your kitchen waste and providing you with basically an inbuilt organic fertiliser.
And so long as you're feeding the worms in the worm farm, they stay concentrated in there, but they also venture out.
Yeah. Yep.
And they also, all the nutrients leach out.
Yes, exactly. And so you just put a little bit of water into the worm farm when you're actually adding your food, and you're leaching out that beautiful worm products into your soil.
Absolutely fascinating.
Wonderful. Thanks so much, Sharon. Let's go to Sally from Warradale. I think you might have some, what's happened there? Sally from Warradale, can you give us a call back? I think we've just lost the line. Sally from Warradale, she was calling about avocados too, so I'm very interested to hear that answer, if she had some insights. So please call back, Sally, because I don't know what happened to the line there on 1300 222 891. In fact, we've got her back. Here we go, Sally. Good morning.
Good morning. Regarding avocado tree in a wicking bed, yes, I have a friend who makes wicking beds and teaches people how to use them, and she had an avocado seed come up in her wicking bed, and she contacted me to graft it for her, so I grafted a fruiting variety onto it. It is growing like you wouldn't believe, and I think she said this year that it did set a couple of fruit. It's only a few years old, and it is doing extremely well.
Well, nothing succeeds like success.
that's fantastic. That's really fantastic here.
Regarding the worm farms, I like to use polystyrene boxes as worm farms, and I dig them into my garden beds and my raised beds, and they have the white lid on top, which is a beautiful sunlight reflector and an insulator. And obviously you try and have them under shade, but in wintertime when that shade drops off, you might get a warmish day and you've still got this white reflective lid on there, and that keeps the worms really happy, and they can escape through the bottom into the cooler part of the ground if they want to, and they can come back into their own little territory.
Well, that sounds interesting. You've been growing, having worm farms for some time, have you, Sally?
Yes.
Yeah. Our producer is busy on the phone. Is it possible you could send me your telephone number or a contact number? Because apart from wicking beds being very much in, I think it's time we also spoke again about worm farms, and people are able to get them through the hot weather, and I think we need to learn a lot there. So if we can get your contact number, I wouldn't mind talking to you, Sally, if that's okay, later on.
Hang on the line there, Sally. Adam will get your details.
Yeah, and I'll ring you back during the week if that's okay.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Brilliant.
Yeah. Listen, we've exceeded our time, and I've still got a few vital questions, so very, very, very quick questions and answers. Mulching, should you mulch your potting, your wicking bed?
Absolutely. The top 5 centimetres of soil in your wicking bed is going to be quite dry because the water's coming from the bottom, but in that top 5 centimetres of soil, you're going to find lots of feeder roots from your plant. So mulching is just as critical, if not more so, excuse me, in a wicking bed as it is in a normal garden bed.
Mulch with what?
You can use pea straw. I actually use another product that's now available on the market called Hooflung Dung, which is a chicken manure-based fertiliser, which is supposed to also provide a little bit of organic fertiliser to your garden. And if you wet that during those really, really hot days, I think that provides that extra level of protection during these hot summer days we get.
All right. Getting started, you buy a plant or a punnet of vegetable seedlings. Just very quickly, how do we get going?
So they need to be watered in for probably a week or two so that their roots get larger and actually get down into that wicking zone and become a bit more self-sufficient. So normally that would take about a week, possibly a couple of weeks, depending on the speed at which it grows and what type of plant you're growing.
The other area is shade. Do you think if you have a wicking bed out in the full sun on 45 degrees, would you be better off with shade, some form of shade over them?
Absolutely. I think that, again, a wicking bed, whilst it's certainly gives you a lot more moisture for your soils, it's not anything that's going to magically protect your plants against 45 degrees. So any form of shade, which, again, goes back to cooling that top layer of soil down in addition to the plants, it really helps them sort of survive.
We've got past our use-by time, I think, Mark. I thought this might happen. It's a very interesting topic, and as someone who I think has been an innovator of wicking bed here in South Australia, you build, you construct, you help people install, and I think it's wonderful that you're also willing to share your information so freely. So thank you for being our guest this morning.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much. Mark Smith from Adelaide Hills Veggie Gardens there.
You're listening to Talkback Gardening with Paul Culliver and John Lamb on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
And we're going to try and get through as many talkback calls as we can in the next 20 minutes or so, John. But we've just discovered a lovely figure, which I dare say our colleagues have been mentioning over the last week, of course, with the Autumn Community Garden. What have we learned?
We've learned that 8,000 people turned up, which would be pretty close to a record crowd coming to an ABC Gardeners Market. But the important thing is $21,000 were raised by the people coming through the door. That's wonderful.
$21,000.
That's a lot.
That's incredible.
All going to the Friends of the Botanic Gardens, and they'll use it very, very widely, wisely in one of their seed programs, which is tremendously important.
All right, well, let's get straight to the calls. A few people have been waiting for a long time, so thank you for being patient on the line and waiting for callbacks. Captain from Streaky Bay, good morning.
Good morning.
Go right ahead.
Mine's about lawn fertiliser. In my first marriage, I finally met my wife's uncle after 6 months, and as we were driving up the street, I noticed this amazing lawn. After chatting to him, he told me the trick. You've only got to do it once a year, and you have the best lawn in the street, eh?
Tell us about it.
You've got to cast twice, so you've got to get sulfate of ammonia, stick that in a bucket and cast that evenly across your lawn. This is 2 days after you cut it.
Yes.
You do this, and then you go over it again with potato-y, and you only got to do it once a year, and you finish up, you've got the best lawns in the street, eh?
So come back to it. You still put on your sulfate of ammonia. What was the second bit that you were putting on?
Potato-y. It's a fertiliser for vegetables, you know.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Slow release fertiliser, and I tell you, mate, amazing, amazing. When I drove into that street and saw her, because I said, wow, what a lawn. She goes, that's where my uncle lives, you know. I'm thinking, geez, I've got to talk to this bloke, you know.
Yeah, well, there are some people that love their lawn, and they spend a lot of time working out exactly how to get it to grow. Yeah.
And it works on cooch as well as buffalo, you know, it works on both of them.
Yeah, well, most lawns love nitrogen fertiliser, but as we're coming back to... the issue
that's the trick, because it's
not just the putting on the nitrogen, it's when you put it on, and now's not the time to put on a lot of nitrogen fertiliser.
No, you don't get too carried away with that, but that turns your lawn green, and then potato is a slow-release thing, that just takes over.
Potato is readily available at garden centres. It used to be readily available. It used to be complete D and E. Is for potatoes. I think it's got more potash. We won't go drill down too far into that one. But thank you for the observation there, Captain. And, if people like their lawns, getting the nutrition right can make a very significant difference.
Yeah.
On you, Captain. Let's go now to Ajax from Adelaide. Good morning.
Good morning.
What's the problem there, Ajax?
John, there are the variety of the moon crop grapes. I couldn't find the plant I want to buy. I want to do seedling, so I'm not sure how to do or where to get this plant.
What kind of a plant was it? A seedling?
The seedless grapes.
Seedless grapes.
They're called Moondrop Blake seedless grapes, which I found on LD in Central Market, but I couldn't find the plant from any other nursery, so I'm not sure where I can get this plant.
No, well, sometimes you'll find that the grapes that you buy in a greengrocer's shop or at the Central Market, they are special varieties which have been bred for commercial producers, and they have what they call a PVR on it, a plant variety rights, which means that nobody else can grow them except the people that have got the registration for the PVR, and they are only distributed through as commercial grapes. It's like some of the apples you buy. You can't buy certain brands of apples simply because there's a PVR on it. But there's plenty of other range. Listen, if you went to a garden centre, a good quality garden centre, and say, can you give me a catalogue of seedless grapes? There are a large number of them out there. In just out of Mildura, there was a wonderful research station, and they carried out a lot of research on on table grapes, and all of those varieties are available to home gardeners. So there are some very good quality seedless grapes available. The other thing is you might like to ring a specialist, like fruit and nut specialist at McLaren Flat, Chris Perry. If anybody has got access to those kind of things, he would.
Okay. Because I took the pictures and I went to the Bunnings and all the other gardens in Clemswick, but they didn't have, said that we don't grow this here in Australia. But so we find these grapes all around Australia on the retail and fruit markets.
Yeah, that's right. It seems unfair, but that's all fair in love and war and marketing, I guess.
There you go. Ajax from Adelaide. And planting a seedless grape isn't going to get you anywhere either, of course. Walter from Tea Tree Gully, good morning.
Yes, good morning. Good morning, John. John, last year I spread some compost around my garden, and this year I've had this magnificent heirloom tomato sprout up. It's grown really well. It's got some beautiful tomatoes on there. Now, how do I go about collecting the seed, saving the seed, and then when is the right time to plant the seed to get some more tomatoes?
Right until they're overripe, nice and soft, and when you pick them, then squash, get a bowl or something like that, a wash-up dish or something like that, and just squash them and make it into a mush, and then wash them. And if you keep on washing them and get a sieve, and then if you keep on washing and mushing it up, eventually all you've got left are the seeds. And if you can separate the seeds from the mush, use some paper towels to dry them out as much as you possibly can, and then double up the drying, put them on a paper towel and leave them for a couple of days until they really do dry out, not in the sun, in a nice cool spot. And then once they're completely dry, put them in a little paper bag with the name of it on, and you should be ready for planting them out in the springtime.
Fantastic. I'll give it a go. Thank
you,
John.
Okay. Just be aware, though, Walter, things that grow in compost and grow naturally from seeds often produce much better plants than something that you grow as a seedling and move the seedling. And it's an issue that we'll talk about when it comes to tomato planting time. The importance of root disturbance can have a major effect on the quality of the plant that you end up with. But anyway,
that's a
story for another day.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Walter, from Tea Tree Gully. More of your calls to come before 10 o'clock. Right now it's 14 minutes to 10.
Start the day with Adelaide's number one breakfast show.
Why do it during school holidays?
We've got a particularly vulnerable patch just north of the surf club here, and we want to drop sand in there so we don't end up in trouble with coastal assets being threatened.
Weekdays from 6.
Have you been able to find us a Adelaide link to the Game of Thrones?
Well, I've come here to Gouja Street, where there's two huge dragons, so the links are going to be quite tenuous.
Don't miss Breakfast with Ali Clark on ABC Radio Adelaide.
You're listening to Talkback Gardening with Paul Culliver and John Lamb on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Let's go to Lorraine from Murray Bridge. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is about a citrus, which is a lime, and I'm not sure of the variety. It's not Tahitian, I know that. And
okay.
It's in a barrel and it's dropping its leaves. What would be the cause?
Without too many other clues, I'm not too sure. When you say it's dropping its leaves, is it the old leaves or all the leaves?
Well, it's just continually dropping leaves. I'm not sure if they're old, but it's denuding the tree.
All right.
It's starting to.
Sure. And presumably it's a well-established plant. How big?
Yes,
How tall is it?
It's a dwarf, so it's probably only about 5 feet tall.
Righto.
In a barrel.
I would put my money on the way it's been watered, or probably not watered. When you get citrus, they have a surface rooted system, so they have a lot of roots up near the surface. And on hot days, unless you're mulching, you'll find that they get burnt and they rely on the roots which are further down. And if there's not moisture further down, the tree goes into stress, it drops its leaves. I would suggest that the main problem is likely to be that the water, when you water, it's not diffusing through the root system. How do you water?
I water with a hose, and every now and again I use something to make the water stay in there.
Righto, you use a soil wetting agent.
Yes, that's it, wetting agent,
yes.
and a fertilizer, a soil conditioner. I put in a bucket of water now and again and pour on.
Righto, well,
and I water it probably twice a week.
Do you? Well, the other thing to look at, if you've got a wine barrel, when you planted it, do you know whether it had one hole in it or did it have a number of holes at the bottom?
It's got a number of holes. It's been in there for years, and yeah. Until this year, I've always caught it around the outside.
Right.
And put new soil in, but I didn't do it this year.
Without actually having another 50 questions, which we don't have the time for,
no.
It's likely to be watering, and it's either over-watering or under-watering. And sometimes if you're watering twice a week, if it's getting over-watered, what happens is you don't have enough air in the soil and it dies. So be careful that you don't over-water it. But it's been so hot, and I would suggest that maybe you're not putting enough water on. When you do watering it, it's not going right down into the root system. You may have lost some of the surface roots because it's too hot, and there's not enough root system down below. And so next time you water, just water as you would normally, and the day afterwards get a trowel and go down one side and just check to see how effective that water has in moving through the soil.
Yes.
And it's quite likely you'll go down about 10 centimetres and it's all dry. That being the case, it's a lack of water, and I would persist with using your soil wetting agent, and I would be really putting on something like that. You'd be putting on at least 50 litres of water when you water it to make sure you water through the whole root system. And once you can wet it up, then go back to watering. And after you water, check to see how far the water is going. And you'll soon work out how much water you need to put on to keep it happy.
Is it the wrong time of the year to core around it at this stage?
Don't go messing around with the root system at the moment, yes.
No, okay.
If you wanted to, you could go down the outside, the very outside.
That's where I do it. Yeah.
Okay, well, what I'd be doing is on one side, go down one side and remove some soil on one side only and backfill that with some good potting mix and some compost and some slow-release fertiliser. And then next year, do the other side, and then you do the adjacent sides. And so rather than doing it all at once, you do it over a four-year period, and you're continually just repotting a section of the potting mix.
Right. Okay, that sounds like good information. Thank you very much for that.
Good, Lorraine.
All right, good luck, Lorraine, from Murray Bridge. We've got, 8 minutes to 10 o'clock. Let's see how much more we can get through before then. We've got Joe from Port Augusta. Good morning to you.
Oh, good morning and happy Easter to you all.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Look, through our hot summer, my mandarin tree got a little bit burnt. Water was kept up to it, but it was just so hot. So back in early February, I thought I would prune what had died out. Then I turned around and half the tree has died back.
Yeah, and I think...
Is that the pruning I did?
It probably didn't help, but I don't think that was a major problem. What happens, I think, is you think you're watering on a regular basis. But if
Water was kept up to but it was just so hot.
But that's right, and it's quite possibly you're watering only half a root system.
No, the roots, it's in a pot and the water was coming out the bottom. I made sure that it was well watered.
Righto. Was the water coming out the bottom, but it was running down the side and not going through?
No, it was in the root ball. I dug in to make sure.
Okay.
Yeah. So was it the pruning that's made the die back? Because the same thing happened to the orange tree. I clipped a bit out of her, then all of a sudden she dropped a half a dozen oranges and those branches died back too.
Well, if you chopped off a lot of leaves when you were doing the
pruning... No, it was dry dead branches.
No, well, chopping off dry branches is not going to have any ill effect at all. So that's not the problem. And again, I would suggest that it's more likely to be with the way you're watering and... It's very hard to describe that over the air, but the only way you'll find out is the day after you've watered, get a trowel and on a couple of sides of the tree, come out about 30 centimetres, go down and see how far the water is penetrating. And it's
I've done all that, but one side of the mandarin tree has got a live branch and it's full of mandarins.
Yeah.
And after I'd pruned it, I could hear my mother saying, "You don't prune..."
Well, you shouldn't
mandarin prune. Or orange in the summer.
Well,
because
you don't.
I did it to the lemon and she's fine.
Okay. Dead branches, dead leaves give you some protection, but pruning in the middle of summer, pruning off the dead wood, is not going to cause the problems that you're looking at. Joe, I can't help you without actually seeing it and doing some digging into the soil and things like that. I would suggest to you it's the way you water and you've got to not just sort of grab the first thing that comes along. You've got to be prepared to get down and check what's happening to your roots. And if you do that, you will learn yourself what is going wrong and you can overcome the problem yourself.
The tree is quite a few years old and I've been using the sea soil on it at the moment.
Sure. Joe, I can't help you anymore.
All right.
And I'm afraid... we've got other questions to go on to, so I'm sorry about that.
Thanks so much, Joe. Let's get now to Jeff from Mount Barker. Jeff, are you there?
Hello, John. I've listened to your show for a long time. Look, I've put in some kale plants, four of them in a raised garden bed. They're about 6 weeks old and doing beautifully, but then I noticed some holes in the leaves, and last night something got to them, and I've only got stalk left.
Oh, it doesn't sound too good.
No. Am I dealing with a slug or a snail or what do you think?
Well, you could be... I was going to say a caterpillar, but a caterpillar wouldn't do that. How thick was it with the stem of the roots? Say pencil thickness?
Of the roots or of the...
what I'm looking for is there is a caterpillar which lives in the soil, comes out of the soil, and it eats the stem, and the stem falls over, but you'll still get some leaves there. If it's the whole lot is being munched,
I've still got the stem, John.
Okay, right. So it's not the caterpillar. It's either... I would suggest that it's probably likely to be something like a possum.
Oh.
Could you have possums in the area?
I haven't seen any. I'm in Mount Barker.
If you've got a reasonable amount of volume, most small insects can't eat all the leaves. If there's nothing left of the leaves, it could be a sparrow, a bird or something like that, munching away. Often they leave little pieces of... They shred the leaves rather than eat the whole lot. When they eat the whole lot, you've got to look at a bigger critter, and I wouldn't suggest rats, but it could be rats, but more likely to be... It's likely to be possums.
Okay. Interestingly, there's chard in this bed, and that's untouched. And there's a flat parsley plant.
Yeah, it's all to do with what's inside. Your kale's probably growing, and it's probably got nice sweet sugars and things like that in there.
Yes.
And if you've got that, then I think that's probably likely to be a possum. It's having a munch on, trying to get its morning sugar fix.
So if I put some sort of netting, some fruit netting over the...
Yeah, that should overcome the problem next time.
Okay. I've also put out some snail pellets in case it is a snail.
It could be snails, but again, they would leave part of the leaf there. If the whole leaf is going, you've got a bigger muncher, and I think you need to exclude, I think, is the answer to your problem.
Good stuff. Thanks so much, Jeff. And thanks so much to you, John Lamb, for another week of Talkback Gardening.
Yes, thank you very much. Good working with you, Paul. And I'll say until next weekend, good gardening.